Gracias por descargar este contenido del canal de conferencias de Euskadi Digital. Visita nuestra web en www.euskadigital.net.
At 79 pounds, which is 258 euros about now. So you can kind of see what the cost of that was. It has had 17 off-the-shelf chips, 4K of ROM, 1K of RAM, and a Z80 processor. Crucially, it was all available for under £100. Its successor, with its increased complexity, would have cost far more than that. So Sinclair was in need of a way of reducing the cost of the unit. A custom or semi-custom devices reduce production costs. They take standard chips that you would use and integrate them into a single device. Custom ICs, which are designed by the end vendor, are very, very flexible, but they are very, very expensive and very time-consuming to produce. Alternatively, you can have semi-custom chips, which are very much more less flexible, but can be produced at a fraction of the cost. Now, the Ferranti ULA, which stands for an uncommitted logic array, uncommitted because these are produced ahead of time and stored in a warehouse, and they only become finally customized at the very, very last stage of their development. And I'll go on and talk about that in a moment. They're semi-custom, and they basically consist of a regular grid of matrix cells. A matrix cell contains two lots of two transistors. So we have one transistor here, coupled at the collector, and we have another transistor here, and then we have a current source, which isn't that interesting, but basically it's got three resistors and four transistors in there. When you come to customize it, you just put over the top a layer of aluminium, which joins these transistors together in any configuration that you want, really. Usually it's to produce NOR gates or inverters. So Jim Westwood, when designing the ZX81, took a modified ZX80 and put all the chips into a design for a ULA. But he couldn't get it to work and had to go away on a business trip. So a person called Richard Altwasser had just joined the company, so Jim left it with Richard to have a play with while he was away for a week. A week later, Jim Westwood returned back to Sinclair and discovered that Richard had managed to get the prototype working. And Richard said that he didn't know who was more surprised. Was it me or was it Jim? So this massive reduction in chip count meant that the ZX81 went on sale for £49, which is 152 euros a day, so it's 100 euros less, basically, in our money. Had basically exactly the same functionality, but so much cheaper. So it contains a ULA for the first time, a Z80 processor, twice as much ROM, and the same 1K of RAM. With that complete, Westwood moved on to do small screen television research, and Richard Altwasser started looking at the design of the ZX Spectrum. Now, Clive Sinclair was adamant that as much as the ZX81 needed to be reused as possible. So, and that included using the ROM code. So using the ROM meant using the Z80 processor again. But as it happened, the Z80 processor was quite cheap, so it was a good decision anyway. Sinclair was also adamant that a Ferranti ULA should be used. The same display resolution and analog television would be used. And as Richard says, it was all about cost. They weren't designing the space shuttle. Altwasser prototyped his design using wire wrap, and in doing so was able to make a few alterations as he went. He found that the blue colour, which would be this colour here, was very, very dark on quite a number of televisions. So he altered that, so it wasn't really a specification, you know, a value, but increased its brightness. And he had to make general sort of timing adjustments to fit into the ULA. Alberta had to visit Ferranti several times whilst designing the ULA. Most importantly, to place the logic units onto the, and I'll show you a picture of that later. And also to route that interconnect layer, the all important aluminium connections. What he used to make his decisions was based on where on the circuit board the ULA pins were going to go, and PCB layout restrictions. You couldn't have signals crossing each other, for instance. At Ferranti, the circuit diagram, like the one on the right-hand side there, would be transformed on paper into an interconnect diagram. That's at 250 times the magnification that you actually see on the chip. That is then digitized into a computer, and an electronic cutting table actually cuts that out of a Mylar film, which you can see there being held up to the light, and somebody is manually expecting to make sure that all the cuts are in the right place. That is then optically reduced from 250 size magnification down to 10 to make something called a reticle. And that is then duplicated 552 times onto something no more than about this big to create a full silicon mask. That then exposes a silicon wafer underneath. And this silicon wafer has already got ULA chips on it, but without the metallization layer, so it's just cells after cell after cell of transistors and resistors with no connection at all. So they cover that in a layer of aluminium, they cover that then in a photoresist, and then they shine the reticle, the wafer mask onto it, and you end up with a disc like that with 500 or so customized now ULA chips. During the first production run of these chips, the prototypes, Richard went to Ferranti's offices, and he was allowed to use a microscope to examine the chips and to put probes in to test each chip. However, whilst examining it, none of the chips worked. Not a single one on that wafer worked. Well, except for one. The routing engineer had forgotten to connect the upper and lower clock circuits together. But even though these semiconductors are made in a clean room where there's no dirt or anything, a single speck of dust had landed on the mask and had bridged where the missing connection should have been. That meant that on that entire first wafer, there was a single chip that worked. And Alberta tested that one chip and proved that his design was correct. So, an absolute stroke of luck that saved them tens of thousands of pounds. So, to summarise, the ZX Spectrum borrowed much from the ZX81. The design of it was about cost. It was designed entirely on paper. No simulation tools that we'd use today. And a speck of dust corrected a routing error, allowing the testing of one chip. Okay. So, in February 2007, I started to reverse engineer the ULA non-invasively. I was basically using functional analysis. And then in 2008, I started to do the analysis on a ULA chip that had been de-encapsulated and had been photographed. So in 1987, the operation of the spectrum was understood, but not entirely explained. So I had the idea, as many before me, to design my own computer to try and reproduce the spectrum's functionality exactly, including the timing, which had eluded many people before. The idea being that if we can do that, then we must be able to infer the operation inside the chip. So I started by building on breadboard, a video generation circuit. I progressed that to a full video display, and then eventually to an entire ZX Spectrum. So from that, what did that tell us? Well, we managed a complete understanding of the contention handler. Both the ULA and the processor need to access the video memory. But if you give the CPU priority, then the screen is going to flicker. So whenever the ULA was updating the screen, it would stop the processor. Now, from software emulation, we knew the timing of that, but the circuit behind that was very difficult to explain. So from this prototype, we managed to reproduce that. And that's one of the things that before now, people had always got wrong. We had 100% accurate timing, and also a clear understanding of the snow effect, which basically is, if you set certain registers, you get screen breakup. It's not a drastic screen breakup, it's been used in a number of games as a bit of a visual effect. However, there were certain aspects of that prototype that could be implemented one way or another, and it would have been really good, if I was going to write a book about it, to really know for sure how those bits worked. So Datel Limited in the UK took about 4 ULA chips for me, photographed the chip in big sections, stitched the images together, and sent them to me on a DVD. I then went to Manchester in the UK, to where the Ferranti archive is, and looked through all the documentation about the various models of ULA they were producing, to compare it against these images, to discover that there wasn't any documentation of the 6000 series ULA, but it was very, very close to something called the R series, and that enabled me to basically work out how all the interconnects formed all the gates. What we didn't know, though, were the resistor values that were inside this matrix cell. But there was one resistor that was dimensionally clearly a 100 ohm resistor. And knowing that, we could measure the size, or I measured the size of the resistor, and could work out what is called the sheet resistance of the polysilicon layer. So then by measuring the dimensions of the other resistors, so all of these resistors are 3.7 micrometers wide and 15.5 long. Using those dimensions, multiplying them together by the sheet resistance allows you to calculate all the other resistor values. So I took the ULA photograph and split it into quarters. So here you can see that top left-hand quarter. The colouring here, the orange and the purple, that's my colouring. You'll see that in a moment. The true colour is this green colour here, the green colour up in the corner, up on the edge there. So I did this in Photoshop. Basically, I put a layer over the top so I could see clearly where the transistor bonding points were, and then I'm using a paintbrush. I marked off each of the tracks to know that I'd done that one. I then had already printed out ahead of time A3 sheets of paper with a grid on it, and this grid would be 6x3 with the transistors, the current source and resistors labelled, and as I transferred those lines from the ULA diagram, I drew them on there in pencil to make up the big transistor diagram. So that's the transistor diagram of that section you saw. Bear in mind that's probably where it's going to be 12 by 12, and each cell's got 4 transistors in it, so do the math. It's a lot of transistors. For each of those cells then, I converted it into logic gates. So you can see here it's 2 NOR gates connected together and, well, a 3 input NOR gate on the other side. And that then gave a logic diagram for exactly the same section. Now, there was a lot of interesting things found in this. The most complicated part to analysis was the memory signal generation. I mean, if you look at all these cascaded inverters that don't really provide any logical function, but they do delay the signals. The one thing that we don't know about the 6000 series ULA, that we do for the 5000 series, is how much propagation delay each of these gates has got. So we can measure the timing of the memory signals from the ULA. You can guess at the propagation delays of the individual gates, but they don't add up. So that was impossible to get 100% correct. But as it turns out, it's not necessary, it's just frustrating. The most interesting discoveries was the CPU clock controller, which was almost identical to the CPU clock controller I'd built in the prototype. It was just surprising that the clock controller in the ULA was very, very much more complicated, and in fact, half of it was redundant. I think that's due to the logical progression that they went through. They designed this part for I/O, they designed this part for memory, and there was an overlap in the functionality, but they didn't realise. So, the composite video generation was all done inside the ULA, which was inherently a digital device. They didn't use any sort of analog in this at all. But they made the resistor values that were there in the peripheral cells around the outside, which connect the matrix cells to the pins of the chip. They made very creative use of the resistors that were in there to generate a composite video signal. Genius, I think. And there are a number of mistakes in the ULA. For instance, there is in the chip, there's a memory RAS signal enable signal inside, which only ever disables that signal if you're accessing the ROM at no other time. So it didn't work as intended, and for that reason the memory refresh that's supposed to be being carried out by the processor can never happen. And the other really, really exciting thing we found was some Russian demo group sort of programmers doing demos on the Spectrum have discovered that if you do an alternating on-off, on-off, on-off pixel pattern on the screen, then just do on-off, 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 and then off, on-off, on-off, on, to invert it, and invert the colours, you actually get darker and lighter sections on the screen, which shouldn't be possible, it's just black and white. And there's an example. All that is a 10101010101 pattern, and then it's 01010101001. But to make sure that you don't have two black lines next to each other, the foreground and background colour have been inverted, but it comes out darker. And the reason for that is that the signal paths for on pixels and off pixels is longer in one sense than the other sense, so you end up with very, very fractionally wide pixels. And I was lucky enough last May, well, a year ago, to meet Richard Altvasser, who designed the Spectrum. And I was telling him about this, and he stood there in the restaurant in front of me saying, it can't happen. It can't happen. Propagation delay, I mean, if you look at the bandwidth of a television, we're talking about 5-10 nanoseconds. You could not possibly see that on the screen. So I sent him this photo and said, look, it happens. But there we go. He still denies it. There we are. And all this and very, very much more is available in my book at a special shop offer of €19. Or you can order it from me on my website. Any questions? I can go over anything else in more detail or... It's not working.
Del 1 al 6.
Yeah, yeah.
You talked about the
producing a batch of the ULAs,
yeah.
CPLDs or whatever. And my question is, are you still planning to do so?
Yeah, the question is, on my blog, I'm talking about producing ULAs in CPLD or FPGA. And am I still planning to do so? Yes. I started doing the PCB design for the ULA replacement. But there was because the signals are so close together, there was a timing issue, and I had to start again, as well as trying to finish the book. So, yeah, I'm working on something at the moment as a ULA sort of replacement. It'll have the ULA Plus in it as well, so you'll be able to have more colours on any game, etc. So, probably not before the end of this year, but early next year, probably the next 6 to 8 months, as time allows.
Hola.
No other questions? Okay.
Transistors. Got a microphone now. In the metallization layer of the ULA itself, you've got this piece of aluminium that all attracts energy. How is it actually attached to the emitter collector base, etc.? What actually sticks it so you've got a good electrical contact between the metal and the silicon?
Okay. Right. The way that the I have a diagram I could show. It'd probably take me longer to find it than I can explain it. It's in the book, so I can show you. One moment. I'll show you a planar diagram, and then it'll make sense. Right. I don't know if everyone could see this diagram. It's a bit small. Okay. See that? Can you see that top white line? There's, and you can see the black comes down into that. Well, that top white line is an oxide layer that has holes in it, down to the P-type silicon or N-type silicon just below it. So that oxide mask has basically got cavities in the top, which is where the connection point to the connection point down to the transistors are, or resistors are. So when they deposit the aluminium over the top, it falls into those holes and etches itself to that P-type silicon. P-type silicon and aluminium makes a very, very good joint. If you use... well, it's got to be P-plus silicon. If you use a P-type silicon, you get what's called an ohmic junction, an ohmic junction, which is a very good insulator. So you don't want one of those. So, you get heavily doped P-typed silicon or an N-type in a well, and that's how it joins. So there's no glue, there's no soldering, there's no any of that. It's just... It just works. Chemistry. Just shout it. I'll repeat the question. Yeah, okay. The snow effect. Right. When the CPU is extracting or taking instructions from the memory, it's basically uses like a six clock pulse cycle to get the instruction out of memory. The first three or four cycles actually get the instruction, and then it does two cycles at the end, which while it's decoding the instruction, it fires off a background read of basically 128 locations, just as one at a time. So there's location 0, location 1, location 2, while it's decoding the instruction to refresh that memory. And it will cycle through these 128 rows of memory. So if you think of the memory, you've got a number of rows, you've got a number of columns. So it just whizzes along these columns. Every instruction, it does one column, one column, one column, one column. Now, when you set, and this is an undocumented feature of the processor, when you set the I register to a value between 40 hex and 7F, which is what, 64 and 127, I think, it will look to the ULA as though there is memory access being made to the video memory. But it does, because it does it straight after the memory fetch, the ULA knows the memory fetch is finished, and so stops looking at the ULA, stops looking at the processor, and just gets on doing its video update. But of course the processor then sticks an instruction or an address on the bus, which is in the range of the video addresses. So it basically corrupts the address that the memory is seeing, that the ULA is generating. So the video puts an address on the bus. Because of the timing of the refresh coming from the CPU, it doesn't see the refresh address. That goes on the bus as well at the same time, and basically changes the row address that the video is trying to fetch. So it fetches some pixels from somewhere else in memory. So it doesn't break anything. It's not a write operation, but it's getting data from completely the wrong place in memory. And because that address is changing from 0 to 128 on a cycle, the values that you get are never consistent, so you don't just get something on the screen that's wrong permanently. It moves about like that. And that's the snow effect, because it's happening, well, every instruction, you get it's in a different location. So that's the snow effect. It's not harmful. It's an interesting quirk, but it's interesting to try and model on your software emulators as well, because people really want to get... Now it's understood, people are spending time trying to do it, so there's like two games that use it. That's about it, really. So that's the snow effect. It's a bit complicated to explain, really, because it's all down to do with that signal timing, but... anything else? Yes?
Might be a little bit of an idiotic question, but is this interest in recapitulating, has it any current application, or is it just historical curiosity?
Okay. Question is, the reverse engineering of these chips, is it just for historical purposes, or has it got any sort of current application? Doesn't really have any... Let's say, it doesn't have any current application in terms of it generating new technology. It has got current application in the, well, a lot of us are here because we like retro computers and things, and these computers aren't going to work forever. Like the earlier question about producing a replacement ULA chip for Spectrums, well, that's one case why. So, I mean... Zilog are still making the Z80 processor today. In 2011, you can buy a brand new one that was made last month. All the other chips, you can replace those with equivalents. You can't replace the ULA, because it was a semi-custom chip. So being able to replace that is important, if you want. Especially if you think of the museums and things that are trying to, preserving these machines. I've had a lot of interest from, well, the Manchester Museum of Science and Industry, because they've got some machines that are broken, and they'd like them to be fixed, you know, they say. But there's also a lot of historical info. The Franti Archive at Manchester, the Manchester Museum, again, kindly allowed me to use a lot of the photographs in the book from their archives. If I gave them a stack of books to go into their archives, because they've got the Franti archive, they've got the Sinclair computers, and my book bridges the gap in between. So it's on many levels, really. And I just find it fun. So there we are. Anything else? No? Well, thank you. You've been a fabulous audience. You have a question or something to say? Why did I write the book? Okay. There were a bunch of guys in Italy called who were they? The Real Spectrum guys. Well, they'd uncovered a lot of secrets, so they said, about the ULA just by analysing it. But they kind of kept, because they were writing a Spectrum emulator and they wanted to be the best Spectrum emulator. They weren't really telling anybody. I was, as I said in my lecture, I was interested in finding out for myself how the Spectrum worked. When I was a teenager, about 30, 14, 15, I loved electronics, and I used to make in my notepad circuit diagrams, and I really wanted to build my own computer, but I couldn't understand how to get a picture on the television. And all of the books you could get from the library were either very high level, so they just said, oh, it's a shift register, and that was it, or they were very, very technical, because you needed to have a degree or be a professional to understand them, and I was in the middle. So in 2007, when I found my old circuit diagrams, I thought to myself, well, I've got a degree, I'm now experienced, can I do it now? And I found out so much about the ULA in doing my project that I really wanted to document it so everybody could benefit from knowing how it all worked. But some of the things that I had discovered, like I said earlier, could have been done this way or that way. I'd be lying if I said it's like this in the book. I would have to say, oh, it could be this, it could be that, it could be this, which I felt was a bit of a letdown, really, if you really wanted to know how it worked. So the only option I had, really, was to take one apart, and I was lucky to I asked somebody if they could X-ray it for me. Got the chap at Datel, and he said, well, X-raying won't really work. Send me some chips, and I'll see what we can do over the Christmas period. Basically, this would have cost me somewhere in the region of about $5,000 for about a day's work. So, and they spent about 4 days on it. So I've saved myself $20,000 or something, you know. But I think, going back to your question, I think they themselves were very, very interested in finding out, because they do this for somebody brings out a new memory chip, and then all of a sudden an exact replica comes out of Korea, and they need to take them apart to see if any patents or things have been broken. So I think they were just interested in seeing what this chip looked like. So they gave me the images, and I had the images, and I had some knowledge. So I did the best job I could, and hence we have the book. So that's where it came from. A labour of love. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chris, for your speech. We have some presents for you. Thanks for coming. Yes, here are a present from Retros called for you. We have our Pachibot Chapela. Yeah. And we have the T-shirt of Retros called.
Thank you.
Please, you have to wear them now. Yeah.
It's my initiation.
Yes. I think it's your size, yeah? Okay, come here. This is the poster of Retroscal for you. A bottle of fine wine from the Basque Country. A bottle of chocolate.
Thank you.
For your enjoyment. And this is the certificate of your speech. So you can put it on the wall at home or your office. Thank you very much, Chris. Bueno, muchas gracias a todos por acudir a las charlas y bueno, en el stand va a ir ahora Chris Smith. Tenéis disponibles los libros sobre la ULA de oferta a 19 euros solo durante Retro Euskal, y habrá una sesión de firmas a cargo de Chris Smith para que los que quiera que os lo dedique estén allí firmando autógrafos, ¿vale? Venga, muchas gracias a todos por acudir y nos vemos en la siguiente actividad de Retro Euskal. Gracias,
Agur. ¿Te ha gustado este especial? Si quieres seguir escuchando más eventos como este, date una vuelta por conferencias.euskadigital.net. Encontrarás todos los especiales emitidos en Euskadi Digital. Toma nota, conferencias.euskadigital.net.